From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was the spring of 1964, June, and Martha Reeves just happened to walk into Studio A at the iconic Motown Records in Detroit. Martha was only 22 at the time, and she saw the Motown singer Marvin Gaye working on a temporary demo version of a song he had co-written called Dancing in the Street. Marvin sees Martha in the studio and he suggests she give the song a shot, and on the second take, she nails it. The writer Mark Kurlansky tells this story in his latest book, which is about that song. Kurlansky says in 1964, the social, political, and cultural upheaval that would be known as the 60s was just about to explode, and Martha Reeves had just sung its anthem. Kurlansky is joining us today to tell the story of that song and the surprising role it played in the nation's history. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the popular writer Mark Kurlansky is joining us. Most of you recognize the name from some of the other books he's written that take small, simple things and explore the larger story around them. He wrote a book called Salt, one called Cod. Both were bestsellers. Kurlansky says this is just how his mind works, and somehow he got into his mind the Motown song Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas. Now, don't worry, we're going to be playing the song as we go along, but you've got to hear the story behind it and the reaction to it to really appreciate it. The song came out in 1964. It was a time when the social and cultural tumult of the 60s was ready to ignite. And some say Dancing in the Street was just a pop song about the joys of dancing and summer, but when you hear it in the context of the time, it can become something else. And Kurlansky says it was the anthem for a changing America. Mark Kurlansky is joining us today to talk about his book. It's called Ready for a Brand New Beat. Mark Kurlansky is the author of dozens of books. I mentioned Cod and Salt. He's also the author of 1968 and The World Without Fish. He's joining us today from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. And Mark Kurlansky, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug.
Well, give me a sense of when exactly, if you can, you came up with this as an idea. I keep imagining, were you listening to the song when it came to you?
Well, in a sense, I mean, I'm that generation. I first heard the song as a teenager, and I loved it when they played it at dances because you just can't dance badly to this song.
Right.
So it's the song I was praying would come on, and then times changed a bit, and the Vietnam War officially started the week after the song was released.
Yeah.
I became involved in the opposition to the war, and other things. Most people I knew were demonstrating on the streets for one thing or another, and we all heard the song completely differently. Mm-hmm. And it always just stuck in my mind the way this song kind of grew up with us.
So explain what's going on in music during this time. The British invasion is underway with the Beatles, the Rolling Stones. Motown in Detroit, of course, is one of those few companies that was holding off the British invasion. I mean, but they're pretty popular right now.
Yeah. The 50s was, the time in which Americans learned about black music, basically. Rhythm and blues was black music, and the charts, Billboard magazine, had separate black and white. Everything was separate black and white in the country, and music was too, and rhythm and blues was black music. And with the growth of the civil rights movement, the idea of integration became exciting for a lot of people, especially young people. And with it came this interest in black culture and black music. And they started listening to rhythm and blues. And white people like Elvis Presley started doing rhythm and blues. Yeah. And It was renamed by Alan Freed, the famous disc jockey, rock and roll, just so that it would have a word, you know, it would have a name that wouldn't be specifically black. So rock and roll is basically white rhythm and blues.
Right, right.
And this is what became bigger and bigger in the 50s. And then at the end of the 50s, it didn't die. A lot of people will tell you it died, but there were still some pretty good people around like Sam Cooke and But it simmered down, and then the British started up. And so by 1964, and the charts were just completely dominated by British groups, especially the Beatles, mm-hmm. and Motown. Motown was the big American music, black music for white people.
Yeah. I want to come back to this theme because you, in the book, you kind of break down this idea of so-called black music and how it plays into this call and response idea, the black style of singing. I want to come back to mm-hmm. that. But let's get to Martha Reeves for a minute. Martha, in 1964, in June, she's 22 years old, about to turn 23. This is interesting because she's already had three hits with Motown.
Yeah.
But she's living with her folks, which I think is great.
Well, you know, you have to understand how Motown worked. I mean, the real genius of Berry Gordy in all this is he was a native of Detroit and he knew Detroit and he understood how much talent was coming out of the high schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, he built Motown on high school kids.
Yeah. She's living with those 10 siblings in this house on the east side of Detroit, has to take the bus. And she gets her start as the secretary to a man we'll meet a little bit more later, Mickey Stevenson. And she's doing some backup singing for Marvin Gaye. That's another part of this story. And as you begin the story, Martha Reeves is sort of heading into the recording studio. She heads to takes the bus there to Motown. Mm-hmm. And I guess people just hung around.
Yes, everybody hung out there. There were things to do. You know, there was Miss Powell who gave lessons in style and comportment, and Holly Atkins who taught dance and choreography, and Maurice King who taught music theory. And so you kind of worked on developing yourself, but also – good things happened when you hung out. Everybody hung out there.
Right.
And, you know, she was not the only one. You know, the Supremes got going because they were hanging out there.
Yeah. You write that Martha Reeves, she arrives at the studio. And Marvin Gaye is in Studio A. He's recording this song called Dancing in the Street. And you say she doesn't really think that much of the song, or at least the title.
Yeah, she didn't like the idea of dancing in the street. It's kind of typical Martha. She said, I think dancing in an elegant ballroom would be nicer.
Yeah. It's a June day, and you say, I'm going to have you read this section if you would. Because Martha, as you say, steps down into Studio A, and you describe it as this not so big room, a fairly small room with these white padded walls and this wooden floor. And Marvin has already recorded the song. Again, this is the demo, and he's using his voice for it. But then he sees Martha there in the studio, and he says to – I think it's Mickey, I guess. He says, hey, let's try this on Martha, right?
Right, which Martha has always remembered all these almost 50 years as, you know, Marvin Gaye giving her the song. And that's not what was happening at all. He was giving her the demo.
Yeah.
Kim Weston had been given the song, who's, by the way, the wife of Mickey Stevenson,
right.
Who's the – producer and one of the co-authors of the song.
Yeah, we'll get to that story in a minute. Read this section.
Martha, at this point, has decided it is a good song, but a song for a male voice, which in fact it never was intended to be. But she doesn't argue with Marvin Gaye. She puts on the headphones and stands in front of a hanging microphone as a music track, unlike anything she has ever heard, erupts into her ears. Normally, a demo tape was made and taken home and studied for a week or two before the recording session. That was what Gaye was trying to make. But Martha just sings it. as she would say later, the way she felt it. It reminds her of summers in Detroit. Someone would put a record player on the porch and everyone would go out in the street and dance. When she's done, Ivy Jo Hunter has bad news for her. The take is great, but they have failed to put the recorder on and she'll have to redo it. And so for the second time, she sings Dancing in the Street. This time, it's a bit edgier because she's irritated. She doesn't like to redo takes. Her mother always said, put your best foot forward so you don't have to do it again. And that is the way Martha likes to work. But when she finishes the second take, she looks up at the control booth window, and the men are congratulating each other as though something special has just happened. It happened in less than 10 minutes. The take, like many recordings in those days of 45 RPM single records, is only 2 minutes and 36 seconds, because that is the length the radio stations like to play. There is no talk of revising or altering anything. Rosalind Ashford and Betty Kelly, the two other Vandellas, are called in to sing the backup. Ivy Jo Hunter sings along with them to show them how it should go. In June 1964, the social, political, and cultural upheaval that would be known as the 60s was about to explode, and Martha Reeves, knowing little about such things, has just sung its anthem.
Mark Kurlansky, why does this song work so well? I think it was Berry Gordy who said it's that first hook that you're sucked in almost immediately.
Yeah, Gordy's overriding principle of songwriting was to have a great hook and set it early.
Yeah.
The hook being the part of the song that you go away remembering, and yeah, this song sets it almost instantly. And by the way, in 2 minutes and 36 seconds, if you listen carefully, the phrase dancing in the street is repeated 36 times. That's called setting the hook.
That's setting the hook. Well, you say to the key to the song also is that it inspires you to do something. Whatever you think of the meaning might be, it really kind of gets you moving.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things. There's this great track.
Yeah.
The strength of Motown was that they went around Detroit and grabbed all the best jazz musicians, and they made these great tracks. This is an incredible track, and Fred Waite's drumming is, a lot of the R&B at the time, including a lot of Motown, you'd sort of pound on the second and fourth beat. You listen to this song, it slams every beat.
Yeah.
And it just gets you moving. I like to play the recording you just played at the beginning of talks that I give, and I look out at the audience and they're sitting there and they can't sit still in their chair,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the other thing is that the words are so wonderfully ambiguous.
Yeah.
They could mean anything you want them to mean. They're about going out there and doing it, whatever that is.
You know, I love listening to this song now, knowing that Martha was a little irritated at having to do the second take. But it was a bit of a trick. Ivy Jo Hunter says, no, we got a glitch. But that's not really what happened.
This was very funny. I was saying it. Martha, although she doesn't live there anymore, has kept her East Side house where she grew up, and it's where she likes to go to sort of reminisce and talk about things. And she, you know, it has memorabilia on the walls. And she brought me there with Ivy Jo Hunter to talk to him.
Yeah.
And she was telling me this story about how they didn't record the first take and she had to do it over again. So I asked the obvious question, I'm a journalist. The obvious question is, so which take was better? Because we'll never hear the first take because it wasn't recorded. And she starts to answer. Before she can say anything, Ivy Joe on my left says, "Look at me. Look at me. Listen, you have this young singer and she's just done this take and it's okay, but you think you can get better from her. Do you say, 'Come on, do it again, you can do better,' or do you say, 'I'm sorry, I didn't record it, we'll have to do it again?"
Right.
And Martha, over on my right, is sitting there with her mouth open. Nobody had ever told her the truth of this.
Well, there is an edge to it, right? I mean, Marvin Gaye thought it was
there
a political
edge. There is an
edge.
There is an edge to Martha Reeves' voice.
Yeah.
Which, when you talk to her about it, she seems to be completely unaware of this.
Yeah.
But the curious thing is that although this song really took off as a song with great political significance against her will, there are other songs that on a smaller but important scale the same thing happened with, and they're her songs.
Yeah.
I mean, Heat Wave, which is completely different writers. It's Holland, Dossier Holland. Movements use that song too. There's an urgency to her voice. Marvin Gaye said there was something very political to her voice.
Yeah. But though she never agreed with him about that, I guess, did she? The political part?
No, she didn't. She didn't like all that. She still doesn't like all that. And she's very uncomfortable with political movements. And, political movements at the time became violent. And, she ended up being accused of inciting violence. And this was very upsetting to her.
You know, I love the part of the book where you write about the kind of origin of the essence of songs like Dancing in the Street. You know, popular music of that time really begins, as you mentioned in the book, with the blues. It was a form that came out of African music by way of slavery, and it's kind of hard to pin down the exact origin, as you say. But there are these elements to it, like call and response, for example. It was a form that was really important to the blues, but also to a lot of songs.
And goes back to Africa even before the blues, before slavery. It's a very old African form, call and response. If you listen to Dancing in the Street, that's exactly what it is. It's Martha is the caller and the Vandellas are the response.
Yeah.
In a classically African way.
You write in the book that there was this African characteristic among some black vocalists and blues singers, which was it came to be known as the black style of singing. It was the style of kind of vocal distortions and kind of growls and, you say, stretching of one note into several tones. Is this Martha? She's good at this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Martha could have been a gospel singer. She was raised in that religious tradition. And that's absolutely her voice. And Elvis Presley learned these kind of black vocalizations. And what they called the freeze, which he used a lot, was an African-American thing. You know, that thing where you just suddenly stop singing and you're motionless and then you hop onto the next note.
Yeah.
Presley did that a lot.
Yeah.
And, all of these things that go way back in African-American and even African music, became part of just American music in the 60s.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, too, because you say the vocalist, I mean, Elvis Presley aside and others who did this. The British really tried to mimic these black vocalization sounds. But you say that a lot of these vocalists would never have been mistaken for white, which I think is important, seems, in the sense that the world was listening to a black woman and the white America was trying to figure out what we were supposed to do with black music, I guess.
Right, right. And that's the interesting thing about the way Motown worked, is that Motown, according to Berry Gordy's plan, was specifically aimed at selling to white people.
Right.
And because it was selling to white people, he wanted to avoid political controversies. But on the other hand, the music he was producing was clearly black.
Yeah.
And, in the early 1960s, to have, white people dancing to black music, especially, you know, teenage white girls dancing to black music, was a political controversy in itself. And there was a huge upcry against it by racists and white supremacists, and it was denounced all over the South. And, you know, people would even say, you know, this music is going to lead to a mingling of the races. And in fact, Martin Luther King credited it with helping integration.
Yeah. I want to. We're going to talk a little bit later in the program about what the song means or may mean, you know. But whether it was intended as a social or a political anthem, if you were black in this country at that time and you wanted to express a political or a social point of view, you kind of had to hide it. This is this idea of masking.
Yeah, which is also an old idea that goes back to slave times and even before. You know, the most famous example was a song called "Follow the Drinking Gourd," and slaves used to sing that song, and white people would say, "Oh, listen to the happy Negro singing about drinking."
Yeah,
and you know, every black person knew that the drinking gourd was the Big Dipper, and if you were in the South and you followed the Big Dipper, you were heading north to freedom, and it was a song about the Underground Railroad. Many, many other examples to the point where it is part of black culture that when you hear a new song, you listen to it to hear what the other meaning is.
Right.
It's supposed that there always is another meaning.
Do you think in some way this made it difficult to pin down a meaning for it? I know Martha says, no, that's not what it meant to me. But do you think there's some sort of subconscious thing going on for some people that they didn't want to be, especially people who were, you know, brought up during that era? It was difficult for them to be explicit about saying, no, this was a political statement, a social statement.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of black musicians really paid a price for what they were doing. Chuck Berry being an example of somebody who was just completely ruined. And so you had to be careful. And Country Joe McDonald, I was talking to him. Now, there's a guy, there was no masking
right to
Country Joe and the Fish. You know, they just put it right out there. And he said, you know, we could do that because we were white.
Right. Mark Kurlansky is with us. His book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. We are going to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 1964, America was on the brink of a cultural revolution. The civil rights movement, portable music, the Vietnam War, the rise of black power, the lead-up to a dramatic election all foretold these great changes here. In his latest book, the writer Mark Kurlansky says that one song in particular emerged as an anthem for the country's brand new beat, Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas. Kurlansky's book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. He's joining us to talk about it. And Mark Kurlansky, to talk about the song. It was written by Marvin Gaye and Ivy Joe Hunter and Mickey Stevenson. They all wrote it together. And was it Mickey's attic?
Yes, it was in Mickey's attic. And by the way, Kim Weston's attic, because right. They were married at the time. And they wrote it for Kim.
What do we know about the writing of it? They just thought of it as a joyous piece? I mean, obviously Mickey is thinking that it means something and
they all have different versions of this. And unfortunately, I couldn't talk to one of them, Marvin Gaye, because he's dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, might have been the key person to talk to because Marvin Gaye was a very political person. He was the guy who was constantly arguing with Barry Gordy that we have to do songs about the things that are going on and not just be about love and heartache. And when he finally convinced him in the early 70s, 72, to release What's Going On, it changed Motown. He wanted these songs to be about these things that were happening.
But
interestingly, he's the one who created the list of cities.
Yeah.
You know, they're dancing in Chicago, down in all those cities are cities that had large, volatile black populations.
Right. And I love the Can't Forget the Motor City, which is actually the actual thing.
Well, that was Ivy Joe Hunter.
Ivy Joe Hunter, right.
Because Marvin Gaye's listing all these things. And Ivy Joe says, hey, can't forget the Motor City. And it went in just like that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about what's going on. 1972, finally Marvin Gaye gets his way. You talk about how Berry Gordy really feared Marvin's political edge. And so he records the song. I think it's June of 1970, you say in the book. And Berry Gordy tells Marvin Gaye when he hears it that it was the worst thing he'd ever heard in his life, refuses to release it.
Yeah. But then he thought, well, this is going to be a lesson.
Yeah.
And it was. But it was, as he himself said later, it was more of a lesson for him. Because the song was a huge hit. People were hungry for songs that were relevant to all these things that were going on, which is why, you have a song like Dancing in the Street, and yeah, it could be just a song about dancing.
Yeah.
The reason why people saw more in it is because they wanted more in it, because they needed songs. The civil rights movement had a whole song division that wrote and performed these songs called freedom songs.
Right.
And they were a different kind of song. I mean, the times they're changing and we shall overcome. I mean, try dancing to that.
Right. And
when there was a break from the old Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, nonviolent civil rights to black power, Stokely Carmichael, A-Trap Brown, these people.
Yeah.
They were looking for a different kind of song. They still had this idea that we have to have songs, but they were looking for a different song, a different kind of songs. They were looking for songs that were clearly and specifically black,
right.
That had music that got people going, rhythms that got people going, this break took place in 1964 between black power and civil rights.
Right.
And there was this song. I mean, there was a growing occurrence of these uprisings in black neighborhoods in cities across the country, the first of which was in Harlem just a few weeks before Dancing in the Street was released.
Right.
And, people would talk about in the spring about, what uprisings are going to be this summer. And, there were over 100 of them a summer. And and here's this song that says, this strong black voice saying, calling out around the world, are you ready for a brand new beat? Summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the street. I mean, what's that supposed to mean?
Right. You say Motown music was engineered to sound good on, car radios or transistors. So this is music that is aimed at young people and aimed at people who are looking for this idea of change, I guess.
Yeah. And one of the big changes in music that happened in the 50s and 60s was that it became portable.
Right.
People used to listen to music in their living room. And so kids didn't have their own music. They had their parents' music because that's what was being played in their living room.
Right.
And then along came transistor radios, very small portable record players, car radios, and kids could go off on their own and listen to their own music. And for the first time, the music business started producing music that was directly aimed at young people. And that is also part of the history of the growth of rock and roll. And you know, this music, you know, that was designed to sound good, basically on bad things, you know, transistor radios and car radios. And I mean, everybody had them. You know, I built my own transistor radio from a kit when I was a kid.
Right.
And, you know, if you could make music sound good on that stuff, it would sound good on anything.
Right. Well, I guess we should talk about, you know, that there are a lot of different versions of Dancing in the Street. Something like, 35 different cover versions or more?
I think it's above 40 now.
Yeah. And I want to talk about a few of them. Some good, not so good. Let me just mention your what I gather is your favorite anyway, or certainly the one that you think is the most original cover of Dancing in the Street, and that is from Ramsey Lewis, his cover in 1967.
Yeah, you know, if you're going to cover a song, you have to have something new and original to add to it, you know, and more than any other, this did.
I love this piece. I think it's really great.
It's a backup of my pet music theory that, you know, all music comes from Bach themes and variations.
Right. It's also pure modern jazz, you say. That's the thing that's really interesting about this piece. It was also new in its concept from that song.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it just – they could not – this great – jazz trio could not have done this with it if it wasn't so musically sound to begin with.
I want to ask you about there are a bunch of other kinds of versions. There's the Van Halen version of Dancing in the Street. Let's play just a moment of that one because I want to ask you about that. You know, the question comes up, you know, can you take that song and twist it so out of proportion that it doesn't have the same kind of connection to it? So I guess some of these work and some of them don't, right?
Yeah, I mean, that shows you can do this song without it having much of a meaning at all. Just
right.
Dance music.
Yeah. Which is, that's absolutely the case with the, you know, the only other, the only cover version that actually made it into the top 10. That's the David Bowie Mick Jagger version of Dancing in the Street, which you say is kind of confusing because it doesn't seem to mean anything when they sing it.
No, I can't figure out what it's supposed to mean. It's kind of silly, really.
Yeah.
They seem to be, if you look at the video, they seem to be trying to be silly.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And it's interesting because I guess it's catchy for sure, but they had other cities in it, for example. They tried to make it international. I wonder what you thought about that.
Right. They tried to America and South America and different places to make it international. But, of course, that completely takes away the meaning, or I suppose gives it another meaning. I don't know what that meaning would be. But you have to do it in its context. This was a fundraiser for African famine and African famine relief, and actually raised a lot of money for a good cause. And it was, you know, it was an international effort to do something about what was going on in Africa. And so I suppose that's why they wanted to, you know, give some international words to it.
Yeah. Well, the original version, the Martha and the Vandellas version, comes out July 31st, 1964. And you said it didn't exactly take the world by storm, but it did move its way up. I mean, it. When did people start paying attention to it at first?
Well, I think that, you know, it caught some attention fairly early on, and you know, Billboard started mentioning it as a recording to watch, and you know, every week the sales would go up a little more. But it didn't become a top 10 song until October. This was a July song. So, you know, it had a slow build. But, you know, a lot of successful songs do. Some of my books have had a nice slow build.
Right. I want to mention that the Sarah Dash, Patti LaBelle version, because their interpretation is this song is about feminism.
Yeah, well, that's what Sarah Dash said to me. She was absolutely convinced that this was a song about emerging feminism.
Yeah.
You know, just an example of how, you know, the song can be about whatever's on your mind. When the book was reviewed in the Chicago Tribune, the guy who reviewed it in the Chicago Tribune told a story about how he had this teacher who used to use the song to teach about the westward expansion of the United States.
Wow. I mean,
yeah.
I just want to come back to Martha. I mean, Martha is she just sees – how does she see it? Because she doesn't see it as a political anthem really.
No, she sees it as a song about – kids dancing in the street.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Mickey Stevenson, one of the writers, saw it that way too, but he had a completely different take on what dancing in the street meant. He saw it as black and white people getting together and dancing on the street. So, right. You know, he saw it as a song about integration. So he did, you know, see it having a political edge. I think that Martha rejected all political interpretations because it was becoming so associated with violence. It was accused of being one of the inspirations for the Watts riot and certainly for the Detroit one. And, you know, she didn't want to be responsible for these things. And so she's taken this adamant stand that it has no political meaning at all.
Yeah. I guess the question we come to is, you know, has it now in 2013, has it outlived its purpose? I mean, is it a, you know, is it a song of history now, you know, vintage or, you know?
Well, maybe. But, you know, it was fascinating to me that in after the World Trade Center attack, was that 2001?
One, right.
The largest radio station owner in the country put out a list of songs that would be dangerous to play at this tense moment.
Yeah.
And Dancing in the Street was on that list.
Yeah, yeah. 70 songs, Clear Channel.
Yeah.
70 songs they advised radio stations to avoid playing, and this was on. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So that interpretation is still out there.
So you say the song today is still meaningful to 20-year-olds, but you say it does not mean the same thing as it did in the 60s, which is fine, right?
No, they don't want the same thing. So,
that's right.
You know, it means what you want. I keep going back to that that movie, Sister Act, Sister Act 2, in fact.
Yeah, that classic.
Yes. Not the sort of movie that you would usually refer to make your intellectual points, but Whoopi Goldberg plays a Vegas nightclub singer who's hiding out as a nun. In this Catholic school in San Francisco, and she wants to raise money for the Glee Club. So what does she do? She goes out in the street and sings actually a pretty good cover of Dancing in the Street, and everybody kicks in money. And, you know, the people who did that film seem to understand that that's what this song is. I mean, the Whoopi Goldberg character in the movie was using the song in exactly the same way as H-Rap Brown used it on the street in the 60s in Black Power rallies, a song to get people going, to get them excited.
Well, we're going to play the whole thing here as we wrap up this conversation with Mark Kurlansky. His book is Ready for a Brand New Beat, How Dancing in the Street Became the Anthem for a Changing America. He joined us from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. Mark Kurlansky, thank you very much for the time.
Yeah, great talking to you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Taylor Almond and Susan Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.